This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
The past whispers to you.
We're here to see Albus Dumbledore.
That would be my brother.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the third and final one of these films, the Endangered Insect Compendium, Fantastic Bees, and the Secrets of Dumbledore. I know it is actually the Wizarding World Kama Sutra, Under the Fantastic Sheets and the Secretions of Dumbledore. No, of course, this bit's well and truly outstated. Welcome. We are looking at the third and final, potentially forever, Fantastic Beasts movie, Fantastic Beasts and the Secrets of Dumbledore. As always, we'll go over some news first, tell you a little bit about this movie, our thoughts, and then talk about some of the creatures we come across in this movie, including the Wyvern or Wyvern, the Manticore, and the star of the movie itself, the Keelin or Killin or Chillin. The pronunciation seems to vary a little bit. As always, this show will be broken up into a few different segments. There'll be time codes below, so go ahead and skip to whatever beast was the one that you thought deserved a happier ending, because let's face it, none of them get happy endings in this one.
No.
A little disclaimer for today's episode. We have had some comments in the past saying that, you know, it's not so much fun to listen to us when we're just constantly ragging on a film. If they're not your favourite episodes where we really go in on something, maybe skip today's, because after two bad Fantastic Beasts movies, we were weeping. We were weeping, and we were wringing our hands, and look, it's a bit of a grump fest today. I'll just say that. But if you want a little, you know, more of a lighthearted, positive attitude to these films, again, go back and watch the first one, because we all love that one. But before we get stuck into that big grump fest, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm a freshwater/invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside Adam Harsik, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, who, alongside the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup, will be joining us later. Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist, is here with me. We recorded today's episode a little ahead of time because Adam and Libby were off on a road trip. After 2 hours of talking about these films, Adam and Libby, they just couldn't hack it anymore, and they decided to wander into the desert. If they return, this podcast will continue, but, I mean,
what are the chances of that?
You'll know it by the end of this episode. News today. Look, this is a bit of a tragic and a bit of a funny study. We talked recently about what roads can do to herbivores or to carnivores, large species in general. There was a really interesting study that's come out in the last 2 weeks which looked at roe deer and moose in Sweden. And they showed that if a train is coming along the tracks, then moose and roe deer will flee from the train, which, you know, absolutely fantastic. That flight response is intact. Great. Not so fantastic was that quite often, especially if they're on the tracks or very close to the tracks, deer will flee directly onto the tracks to get away, yeah, quote unquote, from the train.
Not great.
Kind of funny and kind of sad at the same time. Apparently, one of the reasons is that if they sense danger coming, because a lot of the time they don't sense it by looking at it, they sense it by hearing it or feeling vibrations, they will go for the most clear escape route, which often isn't, you know, through the trees. It's along a very open stretch of ground, which sometimes is the train tracks. So they will flee through the path of least resistance, which is quickly going to turn into the path of most resistance. Great study. The researcher who wrote the paper is Dr. Manisha Bardwaj and her team at the Swedish Agricultural University. Dave, you had some not so funny, but quite depressing news.
More stuff that definitely has nothing to do with anything else that we talk about on the podcast right now. The water is currently so low in the Colorado River that the federal government is actually holding back because they feel that they need to keep the water in order for the dam to keep generating power, which supplies power to 5.8 million people. They announced on Tuesday they will delay the release of water from one of Colorado's river's major reservoirs, which is apparently unprecedented, I have not seen before, and again, probably unrelated to anything else changing in the planet. The action comes as both reservoirs reach their lowest levels on record, with Lake Powers' water level currently at only an elevation of 3,523 feet. And apparently, if it continues to drop, the Glen Canyon Dam, which supplies electricity for, as discussed, 5.8 million people, will no longer be able to generate any electricity at all. But 5.8 million, that's not a lot. I mean... Yeah. It's fine if they go without power. That's not something humans need. We're cool.
Yeah, that's less than 2% of the whole of America, right?
Yeah.
Forgive my Antipodean ignorance, but where is the Colorado River? Is it in Colorado?
In Colorado.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I did not know that that was a deserted area.
I don't think that it was previously, and that's kind of the problem. The river basin supplies water to more than 40 million people. And apparently is important for croplands of 2.5 million acres in the West. So apparently this cut that they've been doing in terms of the reallocating of water has led to increasing areas of droughts for 3/4 of the available water supply not being able to be used to irrigate crops. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, the mega drought that's currently going across the U.S., it's just normal heating and cooling, right, Sam?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what it is. As a climate data analyst, I can say that this is totally normal and definitely not going to increase in severity over the next 50 years. It really frustrates me that people are seeing this now, like we are seeing the effect of climate change in our time. It's not something that's going to happen to our kids. It's not something that's going to happen to us. It is happening to us already.
But the good news is that this drought is only affecting availability of water, food, and electricity.
Oh, okay, so...
Sand. It's not affecting shortages in sand. If you were really wanting to get into that sandbox and get your castles built, you can't use water for your castles, but hourglass makers have been unaffected as their sand continues to be in good supply.
And glass as well. I mean, if you've got plenty of sand, you've got plenty of glass.
Well, no, they've got no electricity for heat, so no, that's out.
Oh, okay. Bugger. Oh, well. And last but not least, on a less depressing topic, or more depressing, depending on how you feel about the franchise, there was a new Jurassic World Dominion trailer this week. I don't want to be a pedantic asshole, but I have to point this out, that there's a Giganotosaurus, or Gigantosaurus, as I believed it was pronounced until recently, and I think it's Jeff Goldblum who says, "What is that?" To which Sam Neill replies, "The largest carnivore the world has ever seen. No, it's fucking not. Whales exist."
And against all probability, a sperm whale had been called into existence several miles above the surface of an alien planet.
All right, you don't need a blood pact to prevent people from killing each other in this movie as we watch Grindelwald's Grundles play tag-urette with Dumbledore's dickheads the entire movie, generously letting them live foible after foible. Newt first saves a horse and then yearns to ride an inexplicably absent cowgirl as he faces off against a now future-seeing Grindelwald that aims to win a rigged election by falsifying information in the wizarding world? Does that sound familiar?
No.
The secret to fighting this mastermind's power is by confusing the fuck out of the audience, I mean him, with the ingenious plan of no plan, yet Dumbledore's plan, but no one can know the no plan, but still go through with the plan. Follow? Yeah, same. Credence Clearwater No Revival, aka Albertius Dumbledore, makes history by becoming the cinema's longest-running MacGuffin, as his entire three-movie role is revealed to not really be anything. Nagini who? And don't blink, because you might miss Queenie's beautifully written character arc that has her returning from her pretty firm last-movie decision to switch to the dark side.
Yeah.
Whew, that was better than the movie.
I'm pretty proud of Grindelwald's Grundles, by the way.
I like Dumbledore's dickheads.
Yeah, Grindelwald's Grundles versus Dumbledore's dickheads. The Quidditch match of the century.
Remember Quidditch? There's Quidditch in this movie, remember? Do you remember Quidditch?
So, with what we liked about this movie, I actually enjoyed this movie. The moment I started thinking about it, however, in any level of detail, it kind of falls apart. But if I was just to go back and watch this movie and not think too much, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, this is like a fun time. It's kind of, you know, it's pleasant. There's some nice victories. Jacob Kowalski is still fucking killing it. The smoothest goddamn line I have ever heard is when he says, Dumbledore says they've got a full heart, but there's no way that's true, Queenie, because there's always a little bit of room in there for you. I was just like, oh, sorry, Cammy, I have to divorce you right now and go and find this fictional man. Just amazing. I still think Jude Law is still doing a really good job as Dumbledore. Jessica Williams, if her accent is a bit strange to me, I understand it's a good Mid-Atlantic accent. I thought she was really kind of, she was interesting. She was a good addition. She felt like she had a bit of personality as opposed to Yusuf Karma, who I do not understand what he's supposed to be doing in this film. But all around, I still, like I said, I still kind of enjoyed this movie.
Nicest thing I can say about this movie is I was not actively hating it as it was happening.
That's a high compliment for you.
Right. I think that I was very pleasantly surprised to see them actually have Dumbledore say at more than one time, like, I was in love with Grindelwald, like very much cementing him as a gay character, which was nice. Although there's a caveat to that, which I'll touch on the next section. Eulalia Hicks, Jessica Williams, is that the actor's name?
Mm-hmm.
Jessica Williams, yeah.
She was fantastic. The absolute stand-up bright spot of this movie. I would say Kowalski, but he's been there this whole time. We know he's going to be great. That doesn't take away from him, but you expect it, you get it. It's great. I enjoyed seeing fucking Ulrich from the German series Dark playing the German, the fucking magical... Is he the president? Is he the current president? No, there's no fucking...
I think he's the minister for magic in Germany. Or is he the...
I thought he was the current one passing down. That was what his speech was about, was passing down the mantle.
It was nice seeing a character pronounce Gellert Grindelwald's name correctly. The bridge, whether they used to teleport from that village in Bhutan up to the mountaintop, was really cool. I really like the concept of the bridge kind of fading away, and then it makes sense because they teleport at the end of it.
From my understanding, the act of mispronouncing of his name is intentional.
Okay.
Is it?
Those that are closest to him or happen to be from the area that he's from are saying it correctly, and then the people usually from, like, America are saying it incorrectly of how you would see it and say it.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
For me, I absolutely loved Callum Turner in this movie. I loved the brother chemistry. I wanted this to be a 1920s brother buddy cop movie that uses humor and then them like learning from one another to mend a broken past type of movie. He was just really smooth. Like, his performance, I think, was one of the most believable ones. Him and Eddie Redmayne had way more, you know, chemistry than anybody in this movie. And I thought they should have used that a lot more, and I'm sad that they didn't. I felt like this movie had some fun moments and inventive visuals, like sparks of a good movie were there. Alas, just sparks. And yeah, to echo the sentiment, I thought Lolly's character played by Jessica Williams was also really promising, and I enjoyed seeing her.
Yeah. And she does turn up very, very briefly in the second film in a like a book or a photo, which is weird because I thought he was like talking to a photo of his dead wife at the time. I really didn't understand what was going on there.
Which is weird because touching onto a retrospective issue with the movie from last week, Nicholas Flamel had a partner, a wife, named in the book. She is with him during the events of the first Harry Potter book, which takes place 70-odd years after the events of the Crimes of Grindelwald. Where is she?
Let's get into things we didn't like with character disappearances. Catherine Waterston's character just vanishes from this movie. She's there for about 15 seconds as a whole, with no explanation whatsoever. Nagini? Nope.
Same with Nagini, yeah. But except she's not even there at all.
Yeah. But by far and away, the thing I hate the most about this is that it does what I consider the ultimate crime of any Harry Potter book, which is it introduces a plot central concept that has never been mentioned or alluded to before ever in any form of media. Most of this film revolves around Gellert Grindelwald running for president of the magical world, which is, not something we'd ever learned about before, and it's just thrown in our faces immediately.
Even in the previous movie was not a plot point.
Nothing at all. It reminds me of the wand lore in the seventh Harry Potter book, which plays a huge role in the book, but no allusion to whatsoever in any of the six books previously. And the other thing that I thought was really dumb was the Killen, or Chillen, bowing to Dumbledore at the end, who by his own admission, I think is one of the strengths of the character, is a flawed human being.
Very flawed.
It should have been bowing to Kowalski. It should have been bowing to Kowalski to show that a muggle could have been pure of heart. I thought they were leading up to that, and then it bows to Dumbledore instead, and it just, it made no sense to me.
That to me was the equivalent of all the kids clapping around Hagrid at the end of like the fucking, what was it, like the third movie or whatever? I can't even remember.
When the hippogriff escapes or when something
yeah,
like that.
It's just like they just didn't know how to end it. So they're like, let's have this big happy moment.
Yeah, so bad.
So and cheesy.
I don't understand how a movie that has this much, like two films behind it, plus all of the Harry Potter books and films, feels like such a thin world.
Absolutely.
There's nothing to it. It's almost like she's making it up as she goes along. But speaking about your comment on Wandalore, again, this universe has five rules. But then in this movie, we see, because I guess they could do nothing else and have lasers shooting at one another, Dumbledore and Grindelwald shoot their magic at one another, and it meets and does the fucking plasma ball thing, which was established in a previous movie, another retcon in the previous version, as what brother, quote-unquote, wands do. Grindelwald has the Elder Wand, which is a one-of-a-kind creation that is more powerful than any other wand. It is not the brother of Dumbledore's
wand. Or the brother of the brother of Dumbledore's wand.
Yeah, the Avada Kedavra curse is supposed to be unblockable.
Exactly. The caveat to my like about this movie, the minimalization of the relationship between Dumbledore and Grindelwald to the point where removing, was it, you said 6 seconds, Sam?
Six seconds, two lines.
Two lines and a total of 6 seconds from the movie makes it, quote, gay friendly, aka keep the gays out of it, for China and Russia, which is really fucking sad. The entire plot of the second movie is about how he can't fight Grindelwald because he made a blood pact with his fucking lover. Like, they are in love with one another. You can actually do more with that. Speaking of doing more with that, where was Mads Mikkelsen this entire movie? He's a great actor, and they did absolutely nothing with him, and it's really sad.
Also, sorry, Jacob and Queenie just get married straight away. Like, she's been cavorting with Hitler for, like, a year? There's no redemption arc or anything? It's just like, okay, all is forgiven now?
Also, Theseus and Lolly, which I love that pairing, now they're just a relationship, despite him just losing his fiance very tragically and viscerally in front of him, less than, I would guess 2 years ago because of how long Ezra Miller's hair is now, but who knows?
Yeah.
I feel like for me, you can't expect a reader or an audience to invest in a journey when you don't know what the journey is. This is how I visualize it. Imagine Gandalf giving Frodo the ring, telling him, this must be destroyed. But then when Frodo asks how, he just gives like a cheeky wink and disappears. That's what this movie felt like. It had no narrative. So it's really hard for an audience to follow the progress of the plot when there is no goal. That's how you relate to the audience of like disappointments or failures, but there's nothing to fail and there's nothing to disappoint because you literally don't know what's going on and neither do the characters. I mean, they say that like it's about confusion. And I just think that that was such a severance of the tying into the movie for an audience.
Don't you mean a Severus?
Yeah, a Severus. I think also it's a missed opportunity. And frankly, I know we joked about her not even belonging in this movie, which I agree with. But if you're going to include her, I think it's a missed opportunity and frankly, big disrespect to Minerva McGonagall. This woman is a badass. Like literally 100%. Dumbledore's right-hand woman. And you cast her as a fucking schoolmarm. Like for shame. Yeah. Minerva, go get the kids. Go herd the kids away. Like, everybody else gets a flushed out, like, you know, story where they get to show them, like, growing into who they are. And Minerva gets the fucking babysitter role. Boo.
Move this man!
Just before we talk about this first bit of trivia, because it is directly related to J.K. Rowling's transphobic comments, we just want to state again, as we did the first time we covered the Fantastic Beasts trilogy, and as we did last week, that we in no way support transphobia and J.K. Rowling's transphobic comments.
Everything J.K. Rowling says with her transphobia is inaccurate, it is harmful, and it is damaging. And as Sam said in the first one of these episodes, if you try to use biology as your argument, which she likes to do, you are wrong. Yeah. And biology, just as Sam said, does not have your back on this one.
No, not at all.
Trans men are men, trans women are women. Get the fuck over it.
Yeah. So we say that to say this because Catherine Waterston is potentially the most outspoken of all the actors involved with this franchise against J.K. Rowling's views. She posted back in July 2021 that she felt that you can't be a feminist if you're opposed to trans people because, to paraphrase Flavia Zordan, your feminism will be intersectional or it will be bullshit. And that's essentially what Catherine Waterston said, that you can't be a feminist if you're against trans people. And Eddie Redmayne has also spoken out against J.K. Rowling, but he downplayed it very quickly and saying that he wrote a personal note of support to J.K. Rowling for the vitriol and the backlash that she faced. So he may have, you know, been able to get back into this film, but I think Catherine Waterston, since J.K. Rowling does have a lot of control over who appears in these films, was not blacklisted, but certainly pushed to the outer. Because you didn't see her in any of the promotional material. And like I said, she's in it briefly for one scene at the end, and she's shown in one shot while the Wizarding election is taking place. That's all she gets, which sucks.
That might have even just been like a contract thing. Like, she was contracted for 3 movies and they couldn't get rid of her, so they had to give her that. Because
yeah,
that makes a lot more sense. Because unlike Nagini, who got even an even more raw deal in a lot of ways, who's just a sex object in the second one and is not in this one at all, to not have the character and bring it in makes no fucking sense.
Yeah.
In another bit of trivia, and I'm going to probably mispronounce these, so apologies. The character Vincencia Santos, played by Maria Fernanda Candido, which is a renowned Brazilian actress, the scene in which she casts her spell to help our beloved Jacob Kowalski, the scene called for like a really exaggerated character motion, but Candido suggested to director David Yates that the character being more centered would perform the magic calmly and like wave her wand in a very like smooth circular way. And Yates allowed her to film it that way and then liked the result so much that that's what made it into the movie.
Cool.
Yeah. Interesting language tidbit. Many of the names of the characters in English are translated, come out differently in Norwegian. So the subtitles will often have very different names. That doesn't usually make it into the English audio that I see when I go to see films in Norway. However, the Cruciatus curse is known as something completely different in Norway, and they don't say Crucio, they say Martirio. Martyr being, you know, a person who was often crucified in the past. I'm assuming it's a link to Jesus on when he was crucified. So yeah, it's the Martirio curse in Norwegian. And it's weird because it's one thing that has made it over into the English language versions that they show in Norway.
Interesting.
Just before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hassick Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit the website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. We're also on Discord. You can find our server if you check the episode description or the website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read a frenetic opulence of short stories. And if you want to hear some of the less movie-related but more ecological science that Adam, myself, and a massive team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, tell a friend, but it would be fantastic if you could quickly give us an in-app rating, preferably 5 stars, and say some nice words about us. Doesn't take long, and it really helps the podcast out a lot.
Yes, please.
So, this movie revolves around the chillin, which...
The deer.
Yeah, morphologically, yeah, of all the creatures we've seen, this is absolutely the least visually interesting, right?
Yes.
There's nothing different about it beyond 2 little feelers coming out of its chin.
Yeah, and it's a little more scaly, I feel. But it could just be very wet, oddly coloured fur.
Yeah.
It does seem to glow as well during its pivotal bout, at least the one that's alive, the bowing moment. But yeah, there's really not much to say about this beyond it's literally a deer. The thing, the way I've always tried to make these kind of, quote, impossible creatures work, where it does something that doesn't actually happen in real life, aka see the future. I don't know if they actually see the future.
Stare into somebody's soul.
They can see someone's soul. The whole ability to, quote, see someone's soul... The only way I can try to turn that into a real thing, I think, is a creature with very, very, very heightened senses, such that, or at least an awareness of the different organisms that it's around. So it will have a very good instinctual and or innate sense of what is and is not a threat to it. You often see capybaras, there's plenty of funny videos of a capybara just chilling, and absolutely nothing is happening, even when a pelican is actively trying to eat it, very unsuccessfully. Yeah. But trying to move its head in any way it can to try to get this massive capybara in its beak, it doesn't work, and the capybara is very zen. And I think that the Chilean is a similar creature that just knows what is and what is not a threat, and that is then interpreted by these dumbass wizards as, oh, I can see your soul. Chilean just probably knows I'm not going to slit its throat when I'm near it.
Yeah, didn't work out too well for it, did it? I mean, clearly it wasn't, you know, alarmed by the presence of Grindelwald at any point.
It was also an infant that was like an hour old, tops, so
yeah,
it might have had all its faculties yet.
But again, this is a creature that is directly lifted from Chinese mythology. Like, the Chilean was I think it's spelt slightly differently. I think there's a W in there somewhere. But they were said to be born at the times of, you know, great leaders rising to prominence. So that is very much a thing straight from Chinese mythology again.
Shocker.
Yeah. And whiskers. So it has kind of these whiskers that seem to slope down from the chin. Deer do have whiskers. Many of them have what are known as vibrissae. I'm not sure how to pronounce it correctly. But they're just used as kind of a warning system. Like, they can use it to kind of, you know, sense changes in the air, use them as, you know, kind of in a tactile way to find out a bit more about what they're, you know, pressing their mouths up against, especially in nocturnal, especially at nighttime where they can't see that, when they can't see very well. So potentially these things have evolved on this creature to, I don't know, maybe it's a trait for sexual selection, like we talked about last week. Maybe larger whiskers, you know, confer advantages to females or to males.
It could be like the structure of a hammerhead shark's head, where it has electromagnetic or electrosensors within there to kind of sense the, basically the electricity firing along the muscles of prey that are hiding under the sand. So there might be some kind of sensory organs in these structures as well that they can use to feed underwater. If they're like a moose kind of going into the water to find some vegetative matter to consume. I don't know why these sensors would help with vegetation as opposed to an animal, but potentially.
I was going to say, in regards to the sort of sixth sense, the closest that I, as a non-scientist, equate it to is horses. I feel like there is a big myth about horses and their sixth sense. but there has been some brief research done into it, from my understanding, from a Swedish University of Agricultural Science, where they tested horses and riders to see if the riders or humans inadvertently communicated fear or anxiety to horses, and they found that horses can read a raise and heart rate elevation of their riders.
Huh. Cool.
Okay, so it's potentially just who they feel relaxed around, like, and everybody else is just guilty as fuck because they know that they've done enough bad shit in their lives to be judged by the Chilean.
Yeah. It's the anxiety. They read the anxiety.
I mean,
so anybody who's just calm as fuck is going to be, you know, judged to have a soul that's pure.
I mean, it would make sense for the character of Dumbledore, who has absolutely no problem raising a child to be a literal sacrificial lamb in Harry Potter. So him being very calm and zen about all the terrible shit he's done in his life would make sense for why it would bow in front of him despite his flawed character.
Because he's a sociopath.
Yeah, because he's an asshole. Yeah.
Yeah, because has sociopathic tendencies. Hey, y'all crazy bitch, but you... So, next up is the delightful scene from the German Ministry of Magic, because, again, no creative names.
Is it a prison? Is it a dungeon? Is it an execution room? What's going on? I have no idea.
Is it a zoo? Yeah. Is it a mine? A mine, they called it.
A mine!
Is it the Mines of Moria? Is the Manticore actually a Balrog? We'll never know. Yes, probably. But they just appear to be basically scorpions that are able to move their cephalothorax up a little bit more than a normal scorpion would, which keeps it, you know, pretty flat to the ground and in a very unassuming posture. But with two tails, because that's how you know it's magic. I'm rolling my eyes. The very stark difference between the mother, father, whatever, the older individual being the size of a building, and the smaller ones being the size of a very large but still relatively small scorpion, is different and difficult to bring into ecological reality. Many different arthropods, which is what this organism would be, have very strong differences between the sizes of the adults and the offspring. If you've ever seen a nest of, or like an egg sac of baby spiders and see it burst, they are very, 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 very tiny and very adorable. But much like these manticores, they are still fully, quote, fully formed. So unlike a baby human, which looks very underdeveloped and half-baked, you have a baby scorpion, which is just a smaller version of the adult scorpion.
In terms of, look, I always bring this example up because, you know, it's the best one I know of these, but it could just be that we've got a situation where you have two different morphs of the same species, whereby it's just morphological plasticity. So you have one group of the same species who have become larger and are able to prey on larger organisms, and the others simply prey on smaller ones. The example I've used before, and I'll use it again, are Arctic char, northern salmonid. Because they're distributed so far up north, often they're the only species of fish within the lake. Some will evolve to eat insects, larvae, and the others will grow larger and become cannibals. And they'll be huge and they'll be preying on the small Arctic char. The example we've used for this, even in the Harry Potter world, was the basilisk, where you have one enormous reptile living underground, seemingly not eating anything. And then you have what I would assume to be a bunch of other much smaller basilisks that feed on rats and mice, and the larger basilisk feeds on them. So I think, you know, potentially you've got the same sort of thing happening here, and there is one larger one that's been able to outcompete others and that is fed by the humans, whereas the others are all subsisting on mice, rats, and the remains that are thrown up by the large manticore.
Which doesn't make sense from the point of view of a predator. If you're going to eat a prey item, or one thing that some of you listeners of the podcast will probably be aware of, because I think we've talked about it before, but in case you haven't heard it, nature documentaries do a decent job of explaining how not every hunt is going to be successful for the predator, but it is a lot lower than you might think. Many different organisms are used to going to bed hungry because they didn't have a successful hunt that day. The orca, I think, has a success rate somewhere around 50%. Which is enormously high for the animal kingdom. Dragonflies, aka the most badass organisms ever, have a kill rate of 95% because they're just that good, but they're very, very, very exceptional in this case.
African wild dogs have some ridiculous thing, like 70, 80%.
Yeah, that's the other one.
Like Adam was saying, they are very much exceptions.
Yeah, I think lions are generally like somewhere around like 30%. It's pretty low.
Yeah. I think cheetahs is at 20, so one in five attempts, well, they will get something. But every time you do an attempt, you're wasting a lot of energy. You're using a lot of energy, and if you don't get food, it's a waste. So for this manticore to take these prisoners and, I guess, drink their bodies in about a second and then throw the remains up onto the shelf doesn't quite make sense, unless this is the mother of all these young, and it's trying to help them get a sense to learn how to hunt and how to consume and also to feed them, much like a parent bird does for a baby bird by consuming something and then literally throwing up into their mouth, which I'm sure Sam loves to hear right now as he's eating. But, you know, these are the things we do.
Koalas shit out food, which is then given to their babies. So it's pre-digested. Yeah. Fecal pap.
Would you say that they're slippy shits?
Slippy shits, yes. Yeah. Yes, I would say it's very slippy shit, yeah.
It's a super slippy shit. Yeah, I think that's about all we can say about this manticore. It's a fun scene, but ecologically it's just one step removed from a couple of real animals, so it's hard to say what would kind of drive these things.
I will say I like that we've included where these creatures have come from in our world's history, and I don't think that you mentioned it. But in case you haven't, the manticore is Persian.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. I was associated with Greek mythology. That's really neat.
And if people haven't seen it before, we highly recommend going up and looking at some of the more interesting or unique depictions of manticores in the past, because there are some truly wonderful works of art out there.
Yes.
weird, buddy. You're weird.
Yeah, so just before we get into the last creature, I just want to have a very quick talk about the diricol, which is the small bird that you see in the marketplace kind of popping in and out of space. Now, these birds are actually said by Rowling to be the dodo. And that when humans arrived on this island, they literally just disappeared because they can just disappear and reappear somewhere else wherever there's danger. So humans think that dodos have gone extinct, but they're actually just diricols and they disappeared back to the wizarding world because apparently wizards don't pose a threat to them. Which, given how we've seen wizards treat every other magical creature the world over, I would think wizards would be much more of a threat than regular humans.
Agreed.
Agreed.
But yeah, that's just kind of a fun little tidbit. And I mean, the birds themselves don't look, you know, particularly strange at all. The only thing that they do, which is a little odd, is just disappear into nothing. But
and then reappear.
Yeah, and then reappear somewhere else. But, you know.
If you want to read a very fascinating history, if you want to kill 30 minutes, look up the history of the dodo bird, because it is a wild ride.
Yeah. In short, island species are much more vulnerable because they generally have much more isolated populations, and it's much easier for an invasive species to come into an island and just wipe everything out, which is exactly what happened with the dodo bird. Just rats, dogs came in there, and because they were in such isolated populations, they were gone, and there were no other populations to kind of back them up or to help repopulate.
Those type of habitats are very vulnerable to any kind of disturbance, and in the case of anthropogenic disturbance, aka humans, we've seen the evidence all over the world, and the more isolated and small a population, the worse it's going to get.
They're also generally much more naive because they don't have to deal with some predators on a regular basis. Darwin's fox, which is a species of fox that Darwin named, the first sample of one that was collected by Darwin, it just walked up to him because it did not see him as a threat, did not understand that he was a human and therefore harmful. And he just whacked it over the head, killed it, and brought it back.
So last up we have the wyvern, which I don't know if Rowling was in charge of naming these, because again, this is just a literal lifting of a name of another organism deciding to call yours a wyvern.
Or also wyvern.
Yeah.
Quite well known as well. Like, it's not like a wyvern or is a, you know, kind of side character from a culture that we're not familiar with. I mean, wyverns are essentially just dragons that only have, like, two legs and two wings, right?
Yeah, their forelimbs are the wings. They don't have wings coming out of their back. So a more, quote, realistic, we've talked about this with our Reign of Fire and Game of Thrones episodes with dragons and Dave's many, many issues with that kind of body plan. The wyvern, yeah, it's a dragon that has its front legs are wings instead of the other ones. But this is basically a shoebill, which is a gigantic bird. Gigantic relative to other birds. They're smaller than a person, than some people, I should say. Look them up if you don't know what they look like. They're very interesting, very funky.
They're terrifying. They look like what dinosaurs would look like to me.
But they look very, very stern. They're the librarians of the bird world.
Yeah, looking straight down the bill of a shoebill into its eyes is a very scary proposition, because they have a very intense gaze. But this is a slightly more rotund bodied, sorry about the cat playing in the background, if you can hear that, with a shoebill head. And it has apparently insect-like or maybe even hummingbird-like wings that it uses to propel its body across short distances. But then when it's time for it to really start to soar, it inflates itself like a hot air balloon, lifting itself off of the ground to carry itself, the case, and Newt, and the baby chillin' up to a desired height, and then morphs this mass into very large wings that it can then glide through the sky with.
It's very odd, yeah. So from what I understand, some birds are able to use their wings to accomplish different styles of motion.
Mm-hmm.
But this thing has two completely different sets of wings that it uses interchangeably. Like, before it starts flying proper, it's not using the massive wings. It's just kind of letting them, like, kind of hang down, and then it expands them later and it stops using the other smaller wings. It's very strange and confusing to watch.
You don't even know it has them
until it's blown up, right?
What appears to happen is, I'm guessing the magic of this organism is that all of the, it's like a Mr. Fantastic almost, where it is a stretchy balloon that then gets, like, pushed into these narrow wings. Like, all of a sudden it's skinny with big wings. And I'm sure Dave would have a heart attack if he saw that, or if he tried to explain that, because it's not going to work. But the theory, but ecologically, or at least evolutionarily, if we're going to allow this nonsense to actually work as a mechanism, it's interesting, and it could be selected for, because some organisms, specifically birds on our planet in the real world, are not able to fly without having a very big run-up to their actual takeoff, because they're very large, they're very massive and heavy for a bird. So you actually, much like an airplane, have to hold their wings out and generate lift to help get them off of the ground. And they need a certain amount of speed to do that.
Yeah, or they have to wait for really like hot updrafts of air to carry them up there.
Favorable wind. But that's not going to happen if you are in a very dense forest, perhaps a, like we see at the beginning of the movie, a very thick bamboo forest. I don't think that's where this bird is from, but to kind of give that as an interesting parallel. If you're a large bird with an enormous wingspan, which this thing has to have at least a 10-meter wingspan, you can't hold those wings open and get a running start. So having the adaptation of blowing yourself up like a balloon to take off vertically, and then once you're at a suitable height, go into your gliding mode would be incredibly advantageous.
Yeah. Being able to hold somebody up while doing all this sort of stuff, difficult. But I mean, you know, you're going to need to use your tail for steering and for balance and all that sort of stuff. So having it, you know, holding somebody up, not the best, but I mean, the use of the tail is very similar to what a lot of monkeys and lemurs are capable of doing. So prehensile tails are absolutely a thing, but maybe not on a bird like this.
Not in birds.
Yeah. But the pouch itself, the throat pouch that it expands, it looks ridiculous, but it is very similar to what a family of birds, or a genus, I should say, of birds have. Or actually, maybe it is a family, the Frigatidae. Frigate birds. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's certain species of frigate birds which have these, when they're deflated, they kind of look like, I guess, a turkey's wattles, maybe, but a little less pronounced.
Like a pelican, almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And on magnificent frigate birds, when they puff these things up, they're huge. They turn into these massive, throaty red sacs that they can generate these really interesting calls through. But, I mean, they're not used primarily for that. They're used primarily as, like, a display, a mating display. So, frigate birds are generally found around the tropics, and they will assemble in mangroves near the Caribbean or Caribbean, however you want to say it. And they'll all be up in the best spots in these mangroves. They fight for their spots really hard. They expand their pouches, and the female frigate birds, who are actually generally 25% larger than the males, will come down and pick these species out based not only on the size of the pouch, that's what gets their attention, but also based on, you know, the spot that they've been able to acquire in the mangroves, and just the male's condition itself.
Mm. So what you're saying is it's not all about the size of the throaty red sac, but how you use it.
Yes, absolutely. Size does matter, but not as much as the use it's put to. Yeah.
And if you don't use it, you lose it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a 2007 doco called Wild Caribbean that has a great section on this, including one of the best puns I've ever heard, which is, the experience of not being able to pull a mate can be quite deflating. And then it shows the next sack.
Got him.
But it is incredible, like the expansion of this kind of throat pouch that it undergoes, because it really is not that prominent when the frigates are not displaying. But it really blows up to an enormous size. So, yeah, the size that this thing gets to, a little exaggerated, but not too much.
Not as much as you would think.
Yeah, but the fact that it's using it for, you know, the locomotion, yeah, slightly off.
Also, is it producing helium?
Yeah.
Because it would have to.
Better than hydrogen.
Well, Dave isn't here, so we're going to say pneumatized bones. So that's
it. Yep. Yeah. It's got pneumatized bones, and Dave would definitely sign off on that. Yeah.
Exactly.
When the bones are good, the rest don't matter. This week, I was inexplicably inspired to write about paper-thin world-building. or rather, what I call world-hinting, wink, wink.
Ooh, it's a good term.
Yes. As in an author that doesn't build a proper world, but rather hints at one and expects the reader to accept it at face value. Upon my research and preparing for this episode, I actually found a very super fun article. Very super fun. I'm a writer. By writer Charlie Jane Anders that I wanted to go through. And it's appropriately titled, The Seven Deadly Sins of World Building. So please feel free as we dive into this to think about the penny-thin depth that is the Wizarding World. All right, so number one, not thinking about basic infrastructure. How do they eat? What do they eat? Who takes away the garbage? Who deals with their bodily wastes? How do they get around? What do the majority of people do to survive? You're not just constructing a society, you're creating an economy. People don't oppress each other for fun, usually. Systems of hierarchy and oppression have economic components to them. Maybe you need peasants to grow labor-intensive crops, maybe you need cannon fodder for your space war, but in any case, there's nothing worse than a fictional world where there are elaborate social structures that which seem completely separated from the realities of food, shelter, and clothing.
Speaking of bodily waste, Adam, do you want to remind us how wizards used to...
Yes.
The secretions of Dumbledore, indeed.
I think it was about three years ago that it came out where, thankfully not a flurry of transphobic tweets, but a flurry of tweets from the writer herself maintaining or alleging that until the early 1900s, wizards would literally shit on the floor and make it disappear with magic. Not use toilets, not use plumbing, which has been around for a very long time, but just shit on the floor like an animal and make it disappear. And they're the ones who are better than the no-mages.
Yeah. In fairness, I think in some of the old German beer halls, you used to just pee on the floor directly.
I mean, that's just for convenience. It's an effort to take a shit on the floor instead of go to the bathroom.
Yeah, it really is. You got to put holes in the chairs.
Also, when you think in context of like, this is a... I mean, it's Hogwarts, right? That's the world. So you're thinking about doing this for children. You know, they arrive to school and they're like, yeah, just go shit on the floor.
Yeah, that's a mess.
Yeah.
All right. Are we ready for number two?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're ready for number two. All right.
Oh, that worked out very nicely, didn't it?
I was trying to work up earlier like a Dumbledeuce pun, but it didn't quite come to fruition, if you know what I mean. Number two, not explaining why events are happening now. Chances are your story revolves around all heck breaking loose in your fictional world. One major world building flaw is not explaining why heck is breaking loose right now, as opposed to 20 years ago or 20 years from now. Often, if your plot is swinging into motion for reasons that feel purely arbitrary, that's actually a failure of world building. You haven't fully accounted for the things that kept your villain in check. Probably also for the factors that kept other political actors in your society in check as well. And that's a larger issue. Every society has checks and balances. Even an absolute monarchy has invisible lines that the monarchs can't cross. Sometimes you can't figure out how these checks and balances work in a particular era without reaching beyond the official history as sanctioned by the people in charge.
Because I feel like they do explain reasonably well why Grindelwald hasn't been able to act before now. Because, I mean, obviously he was... seen as a criminal and he was in prison, and you're kind of seeing his rise to power here, I feel, a little bit. So I guess that she kind of passes that litmus test here a little. I think there's a reasonable explanation of, you know, it took him time to build up this network.
See, I feel like that's you filling it in for yourself. It's not really there in the world.
I don't think she fails that one as obviously as she did the first one, for sure.
Agreed.
Number three, creating fictional versions of real-life human ethnic groups that never go beyond one dimension. This is a huge problem that tons of creators seem to struggle with. As a rule of thumb, if you want to have Belgians in your novel, you're going to have to try and create an accurate view of Belgian society. If you decide that instead of Belgians, you're going to have an alien species called Bezelgians, who are basically Belgians, except they've got antlers, you still have to try to make them well-rounded and nuanced as possible. Ditto if you're creating a secondary world where that happens to be a land of magical creatures called the Belge, who are still basically Belgians. Really, you should make sure that any cultural or ethnic group you create has multiple dimensions in a sense that its members have their own subjectivity and a believable culture, whether it's the culture that your main characters come from or a culture that they see as the, quote, other. But it's also a really good rule of thumb that the more your fictional group resembles real-life Belgians, the more you ought to worry about being true to life. Changing Belgians to Bezelgians doesn't really let you off the hook for presenting a true-to-life portrait of people from Belgium.
If you want to see the ultimate failure of this, see the introduction of the different schools in the fourth Harry Potter movie.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think to me, and this isn't exactly what she's talking about in this article, but it kind of fits to me. I don't really see a big division between what wizards are and what muggles are, other than that they can do magic. And to me, that's not really indicative of a different culture. Like, you act and behave the exact same way, and we're supposed to believe that, like, a group of wizards, you know, like Grindelwald, seem to believe that they're higher and better than humans, but they really kind of act exactly like humans. So I don't really understand the differences there.
And it's not like there's not an obvious solution for this. I mean, we have had, like, humans persecuting, quote-unquote, witches and wizards in the past. You could have easily made Grindelwald a kind of Magneto-type character, where you have him grown up, persecuted by humans, which you do see some of in some of the other movies, like, for instance, Snape and Lily Potter both get called freaks all the time, but it never really goes beyond that. Like, and you could have easily made him Magneto and had a genuine reason for him to hate muggles.
Absolutely.
You don't see that at all in these movies.
And that's, I mean, that's a lack of world building, because if your character doesn't have a motivation for what they're doing, then why are they doing it?
I think this is a good time to step in and say that Adam and I really enjoyed these books as kids. Adam and I still enjoy the first Fantastic Beasts film. I still enjoyed this third one, but we have to talk about the fact that there's no world here.
No, there isn't.
And I'm just shitting on everything, so.
Yeah, Libby is shitting liberally on everything.
But I'll wave a wand and make it disappear, so it's all right.
Perfect.
Number four, creating monolithic social, political, cultural, and religious groups. Everybody in a particular ethnic group agrees about everything. Every member of the ruling class or the working class agrees about everything. Every citizen of a particular nation holds the exact same set of opinions. There is one version of history that absolutely everybody agrees on. Every member of a religion interprets the tenets of that religion in the exact same way. Does that sound plausible? Maybe if you've never been around actual humans. In real life, if you get three members of a particular in-group together, you'll probably hear four different opinions on most of the group's major concerns. Asserting that all Christians agree on all matters of doctrine is probably a good way to get laughed out of the room. So when you imagine the ruling class of your world, it's safe to assume that no two members will agree on much. And when you retell your fictional history, remember that nobody is likely to agree on what actually happened.
That, I think, is a just essentialism, basically. And that's what these movies have always been. If you're in Gryffindor, you're the main character of the book, so you're a good person. But if you're a Slytherin, you're obviously a slimy weasel, and you all feel the same.
In terms of rampant essentialism, I mean, I think we talked about this last week, the fact that Snape turns out to be, you know, a good character, despite the fact that, fuck off, he's not. He's basically an incel, despite the fact he was in Slytherin. But when Dumbledore says, you're a good person, he doesn't say, you know, you're a good person, despite the fact you're a Slytherin. He says, you're a good person, you should have been in a different house, basically. Like, he's not saying Slytherins can be good. He's saying, you were put in the wrong house.
Slytherin.
Exactly. Yeah.
Number five, inventing a history that is totally logical. In an imaginary world, the strongest side always wins, and the people who are in charge are always the descendants of the people who were in charge 100 years ago. But real life isn't like that. History is full of odd quirks, happenstances, and powerful people often make huge miscalculations that wind up costing them dearly. Just think about weird happenstances like Ireland being divided in half, or Korea, or Germany for nearly 5 decades. History is weird. Things that seem inevitable in retrospect usually seem anything but at the time. So totally logical history will never pass the smell test.
I feel like the history's delved into in such a superficial manner that we can't tell whether or not it makes sense.
Exactly. There is no real history.
Yeah.
I feel like the only, quote, history that I'm aware of is not even from the books itself or the movies, or these movies in particular, but more from either a tweet that maybe Rowling put out, but basically saying that the witch trials is what divided the world of the magic world from the non-magical world. And that would make sense, because you could tie it into real world history where a lot of people, most of them women, were killed for no fucking reason. But it's not included in this at all, and it's just, oh, we're separate, but we're still living, we're hiding in human society like fucking vampires.
Yeah. I will say, to that point, you know, obviously this can happen, so it's not a great example, but just Dumbledore being in charge for ever, you know,
like,
yeah, at Hogwarts. Obviously long reigns do happen, so you our Queen Elizabeth. But
my Queen Elizabeth, not yours.
Thank you.
But you know, as we know in history, that's pretty rare. So I'm not saying that this is the best example because it can happen, but also that's a pretty rare thing to happen for him to be the leader of the school for so long. Speaking of smell, not really giving a strong sense of place, like what it smells like after it's been raining. You can spend hours and hours thinking about the history and culture and mores of your imaginary land and how people interact in the ways that different religion and ethnic groups collide. But if you don't make me feel the dirt under my fingernails, then you still haven't created a real place. Preach. If the reader doesn't get a little lightheaded from the stench of the polluted river or transported by the beauty of the geometric flower gardens, then something is missing. Most of all, there should be a few spots, bars, taverns, crypts, spaceport, where the reader really feels at home. As if you could imagine hanging out there for real. The purpose of world building isn't just to do a cool exercise, but to give the sense of place, and all of your thought experiments absolutely have to result in something vivid and alive.
In Fantastic Beasts, we never really get a sense of that. Even in like Newt's home, it never happens.
To play devil's advocate, I do think there is a brief bit of this that is done with Hogwarts itself. I do agree that Hogwarts looks different, but I think, at least for the movies, I cannot speak to the books because I've never read them. Whenever you go into that great hall and you see the candles in the ceiling, I know as an audience, you feel very like, oh, like you're in the great hall, you know?
Yeah.
And it makes you feel cozy and it makes you feel that kind of like magic wonderment of the food appearing on the table, or the decorations changing for the season. So I think there is a bit of it, but like you were saying, I agree. I don't think there's a lot of it.
Yeah. I think I agree with what both of you were saying about the Great Hall evoking that feeling. I think for me, it does that. I get that feeling from the Great Hall specifically and a little bit from Hogwarts. But I think that only comes from my association with those movies at a very specific time in my life, not the movie itself. I have that same feeling with the Lord of the Rings movies. But I also have that feeling with the world of Middle-earth. And reading the books themselves, I could tell you what every single one of those parts, areas of those books feel like. And what it would be like to be in those areas, be it Hobbiton, be it the Shire in general, be it Rohan, be it, you know, Mordor or Helm's Deep. Like, those all have very distinct and noticeable feelings. Or the town of Bree, even, which is supposed to be very similar to Hobbiton, but nothing in this universe, the movies, the books, the old movies, these movies, has a feel to it. And I think that's a real shame.
Even when they go back to Hogwarts, I really feel it feels so empty and devoid of life.
Super sterile.
I had that same reaction. It felt very hollow.
Yeah, especially like when Leta Lestrange is walking around Hogwarts in the second movie, it's just like, where is everyone?
Yeah. I honestly feel like, I know this is about Fantastic Beasts, but I do honestly feel like part of the reason the first Harry Potter movies and the first part of the first Harry Potter movies were such a success is because there were moments of that sensory connection. Like, I can think about what Hagrid's hut looked like. I think that there's moments of, like, you have these establishing shots of places and feelings kind of in the places. But I feel like with Fantastic Beasts specifically, everything is just so focused on the action of the movie that you're never in one place for more than 2 seconds anyways. So you never really connect the place that you're in, and thus it feels like a hollow world because you don't even know where you are half the time.
I do like Jacob's Bakery though. As Libby said last week, I feel bad that it's definitely going to be shut down in a couple of years by the Great Depression.
Yeah. Absolutely. Last but not least, 7. Introducing some superpower, like magic or insane tech, without fully accounting for how it would change society. If your pitch is, quote, it's just like our world, except everybody can turn invisible at will, then you've already failed. Because if everybody could turn invisible at will, it wouldn't be anything like our world. Especially if this power had been around for a few months. Whether you're creating an alternate history or a secondary world or a far future, any technology or power you introduce is going to have far-reaching effects. Not just first-order effects, but second- and third-order effects, too. Going with the invisibility example, you'd have people start using it to spy on each other. But you'd also have this huge boom in heat sensors. We'd start redefining the whole concept of privacy, and pop culture would be massively transformed. There would be a whole art forms based around invisible performers, and it might be legal to shoot an invisible intruder on site. You could be here for hours imagining all the ways that the universal power of invisibility would change the world, and you'd probably still just be scratching the surface.
This is a big problem. Not so much with these movies, although, you know, there are creatures that should be reused in certain points, but I think the most egregious use of this is the time turners.
Yep.
From the third Harry Potter movie. Just like, that is revolutionary technology that could solve a lot of problems, and they immediately had to write that out two books later just to be like, oh yeah, these were all destroyed, so don't worry about them anymore.
Not even revolutionary. That is reality breaking.
Yeah.
That would change the fundamental nature of whatever universe you're living in. And for it to be used by a 13-year-old girl to go to more classes
is yeah.
bizarre.
I like the rules of time travel in that universe as well. Like, that you can't change things. They are always going to happen as they happened. As with the last 2 weeks, I feel we have to go with this question again. Which of the creatures do we feel the worst for? Do we feel the worst for the Chillin that is slaughtered and brought back to life repeatedly? The Manticore, which is shoved into a dungeon and fed human remains? Or the Diricore, which was exterminated by humans and has had to live amongst wizards who are objectively even worse? Which one?
Diricore seems to be having a great time in Bhutan. Seeing the reanimated Chillin stumbling around the steps was heartbreaking and honestly very difficult to watch and frankly upsetting. So definitely that one.
The hardest part of this movie was the birth scene. I think, the reanimation was like grotesque, but at least in my mind, I'm like, it's already dead. The birth scene of like the mom, which by the way, another plot hole, getting hit twice with a death curse and still living. The scene of her, you know, still being alive and, like, in huge amounts of pain, and then, you know, the baby's, like, taken and traumatized, and then obviously you see it die later. And then you have the newborn, the twin that just, like, is welcome to Earth, and, you know, your mom's dead, your brother's dead, or sister's dead, like, have fun in a suitcase, because that's your life.
That's all there is.
Oh my god, like, heartbreaking. Especially given how beautiful the surroundings were, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I feel very bad for the Keelin or the Chillin, yeah.
Oh no, please don't.
Not like this. Not like this.
Would we recommend this movie?
I'm gonna say no. I mean, the first part is fucking sad as shit. And then the rest of it just doesn't make any sense, so...
And nothing happens.
Yeah. Absolutely not. Watch the first Fantastic Beasts, and then don't watch anymore.
Yeah, if you've watched the second movie, then you should just watch this one anyway. Like I said, I liked it, but I can understand that objectively there's so many fucking problems with it. But if you haven't seen the second one, just don't worry about it. Just stick with the first one, pretend nothing else happened. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't need to see anything else from this.
Yeah. Yeah, I still maintain I like this movie though. I mean, it's better than the second one. We can say it's better than the second one, right?
We can.
You know, that's like what happens in abusive relationships, Sam. You're deprived and then you think that this trash is so much better.
It never hit me until this film how paper thin everything was.
Yeah.
And it really makes me dislike this film more because it was a revelation about all the other films. Like I said, I still kind of like this film, but watching this film makes me dislike the Harry Potter films themselves more because
welcome
it's just
to the dark side.
Yeah, it really brings to the surface how superficial this whole world is, which sucks.
It is. And I think it's sad because, you know, I maintain I will never read the books. From what I've read, I strongly dislike it. The movies are objectively horrible if you go back and watch them.
No, they're good.
No. I still maintain, though, that there is there is good parts in them, and I understand why they are popular with so many people. And I still feel happy in certain scenes in the movies. And it's not just from nostalgia, although that is a strong part of it, but it is because of the idea of this magical world. And I feel like visually, again, I'm just talking about the movies here, visually, it was really, you know, enticing. I think it's a shame because when you have, as I've coined the world hinting that she's done, all it leaves me with is just wanting more, and not in a good way, in like an unsatisfied way. I was given a scrap of food and I'm starving, and they say, well, imagine what the rest of your dinner's like.
And it's annoying because I thought that's what we were getting after this first Fantastic Beasts film, and the second and third have just not delivered on that at all. I thought the only interesting magical fight in this was when Credence was, you know, bringing all the buildings down on Dumbledore. I thought that was good. I thought that. But then it all happened in his mind because the droplet of water.
And the reflection.
Yeah.
This is a fucking mind palace from Doctor Strange. Like, what the fuck is this? Why is Ezra Miller holding their wand like this? What the fuck? Who let them do that? God. So stupid.
But you know how, like, you see gangsters in films holding guns like that the whole time?
That's exactly what I thought of. This is how I hold my wand, bitch.
Yeah.
The promotional photo was there outside the theater, and Ezra Miller had their wand, you know, fucking a balled up fist in front of them, with the head of the wand facing the bottom of their fist. So imagine your fist to your chest, and your wand is poking outwards, and their hand underneath it, like they're cradling someone's testicles. Like, surely that's not what they're going to do in this movie. And lo and fucking behold, they do.
God, I hope there's no recoil or he just, like, bangs himself in the throat. Like, exactly. Can't breathe for 5 minutes.
Wand recoil is something that needs to be explained.
Yeah. Oh my God, that'd be so much more interesting if there was.
Yeah. I love the idea of, like, wizards building up their, like, wrist strength in the gym, like, doing those, like, the little mini curls. Like, you know, yeah.
So next week we'll be moving away from the, quote, magical, question mark, world of the wizarding world, quotations around world, towards evolution, a much more entertaining and fun movie.
Another terrible movie, but such a fantastic one.
But a good terrible movie, and I'm really excited because I haven't watched this in probably 20 years, so...
I rewatched it a couple years ago, and I laughed my ass off.
It's so much fun, isn't it? It's just,
Evolution next week, as we say here at the end of every episode, Harry Potter movies are terrible, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
I still like this movie. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is the team that's going to take down the most dangerous wizard in over a century. A magizoologist, his indispensable assistant. A wizard descended from a very old family, a school teacher. And a muggle.